Hey team, okay, this was a really cool one. David Luderus joins me once again, and we had Greg Chalmers. And Greg is probably the greatest putter over the past 20 years, played 461 US Tour events. Luda, how cool was that?
Oh, it was fantastic. You know, as same with you, Baden, we've known Greg since we were kids, and two-time Australian Open champ. He's won on the PGA Tour, and his putting record, it speaks for itself. He's one of the greatest putters of all time. So he was fantastic and really, you know, gave away a few great secrets for people to listen to. So people are going to love this one.
Yeah, I totally agree. There's a lot of really cool practical stuff. Like after we talk about his career towards the end, he gives some really good nuggets that you can use to make yourself a better putter. But to celebrate Greg actually coming on to Skillist, which we're super excited about, we're actually doing a giveaway. So you need to just subscribe to the pod, leave a comment, and we're going to grab someone out. We're going to give you a free Zoom and putting analysis with Greg Chalmers, greatest putter in the world in the last 20 years. That's pretty good. So enjoy this pod. I think you're going to love it. And we will see you on the other side. Okay, my people, here we go. This is going to be a super cool one. This man, Greg Chalmers, he's just been in my life from pretty much the age of five. He's competed every single summer on the Australian Tour. He basically finishes top five in every single event, but has played for the last 20 years or so on the US Tour, has played 416 events on the US Tour, which is just frightening. I think maybe only one guy at the moment has played any more than that. Has won 11 times on tour globally. Just an absolutely incredible player for a very long time. One of the best putters. We'll talk about some of your stats in a second, Greg. Pretty much one of the best putters in the world over the past 20 years as well. Super exciting to have you here, mates. And Luda, how pumped are you, mate, being an Aussie yourself, to have Greg on?
Yeah, no, it's fantastic. I remember watching Greg at the 98 Australian Open at Royal Adelaide, one of my local tracks, and he won that one and then obviously won another Australian Open. But yeah, Greg's a great guy and one of the greatest putters of all time. So fantastic to have him on today.
Great to have you, Greg. What's happening in your world?
Oh, nothing, mate. I'm over in Dallas, Texas. I just, you know, entered this coaching world a little bit, so I'm still playing myself. So, you know, and as you know, through Skillist now, I'm passionate about putting, so I've entered the coaching world through Skillist in that area, and I coach members at my club, Full Swing stuff as well. But really, I'm happy to do that for them. But I really love talking about putting and chatting and helping people with that. So. Thanks for having me on. I'm looking forward to the chat.
Yeah, no, it's going to be great. And we're going to dive deep into some technical stuff and also how you've sort of like become the putter that you are. But let's talk about a bit of news. Like, how can we not? Like, the last week, it's pretty juicy start to the year. I'm kind of getting really excited about this golfing season. The Waste Management has now turned into, I don't know what, like it's now like one of the big events on tour. Like, some would say for the right or wrong reasons, I reckon it's absolutely fantastic. Like, I think that, you know, it is so good at breaking down barriers, and it feels like there's a huge movement in golf at the moment where everything is becoming more accessible, whether it's coaching, indoor facilities, hitting in the simulators, whatever it is. It just feels like golf's getting more accessible. Give us your take on it and, you know, what you've seen the event turn into over the years.
Yeah, so I've been going there since 99, my rookie year. And in those days, they didn't have the extensive stands. They had a lot of people on that 16th hole, but they didn't have the stands and the grandstands they have now. It is literally like you're playing in a football stadium right now. You walk through a cave, basically, to get onto the tee. You're fully encased in this environment that's super intense. And the whole week, really, it feels like, as a player, that you're actually in the background a little bit. Like, it's a very great people event, people watching event. You're going there for the party as a fan. I'd say the vast portion of people are there because it's such a big event. Personally, I love it. I don't know if I'd want to do it every week. You know, it's the first time only I've been told I've got a fat ass and, you know, people abuse you and things like that. So I've had a few people yell at me that are pretty interesting. But I'll say this. It has an opportunity. I said to someone today, I was just chatting about this with a friend of mine, it actually has an opportunity to turn entertainment and golf. Like, golf is a form of entertainment. So we could really, if they wanted to, they could go all in and embrace that. I mean, you could really do some crazy things because they have a DJ there already in between groups. If you wanted to, you could, I mean, This sounds crazy, but I was thinking, why don't I install a half pipe and have a little in between groups, have a little BMX or skateboard thing going on. I don't care if they drop in off the top of the grandstands, mate. Like, so you could really turn this into a, just an absolute show within the stadium if you wanted to, right? They have, it's a crazy week. You know, you're talking about 500,000 people start to finish. And for a golfer, it's quite intense.
Do you think, so you would only do that for this event though? Like you couldn't do this even multiple times a year, I don't think. I think it's probably a 1 week, a year sort of thing.
I think if you had other events have tried to do it, you can't manufacture this. It has to be fully embraced by the fan base. Flint, Michigan, Luter, I don't know if you ever remember, we used to go to Flint, Michigan. They did it on 17. They get all the fans right up close and they start screaming as soon as you make contact with your putt. That is, they don't have the population, right, that Phoenix and Scottsdale has. This has grown organically from just a very popular event into now this massive event. And so you can't force that. It either has to happen organically and people embrace it, the fan base. And now that's in. So to me, just go all in. You know, do whatever.
No, I agree. I think Flint, Michigan was an absolute riot. I remember that. But yeah, this waste management's just gone to another level. I think JT, it was interesting watching him. Obviously, the whole two hole in ones on the weekend, you know, with the spraying the beer and then throwing all the cans on the hole. That's where some people are sort of torn. Is that too far? I think, look, from a entertainment standpoint, it's absolutely fantastic. But yeah, I think Justin Thomas was avoiding beer cans. I think he got hit in the back, and I mean, it's a fine line, but I think it's great for the game, you know.
Totally. I think if people are watching that, like, because when it was happening, I'm like, this is going to be all over the news. Like, even on like news channels that never show golf, like, this is 100% going to be on the news.
Exactly.
And if it just makes more people say, wow, maybe it's not a game for super old white guys, right? Maybe it is like a game that's just a little bit more accessible and a bit more fun. I just think, and the timing couldn't be any better with the growth of golf over the last couple of years, just like everything feeling a bit more accessible, an event like that happening. I just, yeah, personally, I love it. I totally understand what you're saying though, Luda. Like, the last thing you want is like Justin Thomas getting hit in the back of the head and being knocked out. Like,
Luda, they've always kind of danced that line at that event. Like, they've received phone calls, I guarantee you, every Monday from the tournament, from the high-ups at the PGA Tour, saying, hey, tone it down. They've had officials walk with the last groups on Saturdays every few years. And then they slide back into this behavior where you kind of need to tone it down just a hair again. Maybe we only celebrate hole-in-ones in that level. You know what I mean? Where,
exactly, you know. Exactly. I will say this. What that tournament does well, and obviously, Greg, your local event, at least when it was at Las Colinas, the Byron Nelson, Baden, so many people in America will go to the PGA Tour events who don't even follow golf because they get the social aspect right. They get the entertainment right. And it's like in Australia going to the races. Like, it's the equivalent. Like, everyone goes, whether you're 21, whether you're 50. Like, it's like a social fun thing to do. And that's why I think the tour over here is such a big deal. People just love it. It's a lot of fun, you know.
Well, that's really cool segue. Thanks for that, Luda. Let's talk about the tour in its current format. You know, I love the tour. Like, personally, like, I love waking up and, you know, watching it first thing in the morning. But there's definitely a sense, when you think about it, of a little bit of the sameness and the monotony, I suppose. It's been the same way forever. Like, the formats haven't changed, really. They completely, pretty much eliminated any match play out of it, except for one of the GC events. And now we've got people knocking on the door saying things can be done differently. We saw Charlie Hoffman have a massive blow up on the weekend, obviously, and, you know, intimate that everyone's leaving. Do you want to give us, like, obviously you're a member of the PGA Tour still, so, you know, say what you can, but what's the feeling you get around people's inclination to want to try something new, I suppose?
I would say is, you know, from what I understand, the players, and I don't live in the world that the players they're talking to, you know, like, I don't live in that world. But I will
120 million to
$1.20, you know, or a but I will say the players have appreciated the competition, right? And no one is exempt from doing a better job, including the PGA Tour. And for a long time, it's been, you know, autonomous. They do whatever they want. There was no one there pushing them and driving them to change their product in any way, shape, or form. And us as competitors now sort of look at that. I think a lot of the players are looking around going, well, hang on, we are competing day in, day out to get better and better and better. Maybe there is some things that could force you to do a better job. And all of a sudden they found $40 million to give away for who tweets the most. They're giving $50,000 to 150 players or, you know, everyone who plays 15 events. You know, all of a sudden these things just start popping up through competition, right? Yep. Aside from, this is all putting aside, of course, the obvious elephant in the room, where the money is coming from in from this, you know, Saudi option. I'm disappointing thing is that side of it, the politics of that, because if that money came from just anywhere, this would be an unbelievable opportunity because it'd drive golf through the moon, right? That's the part of it that is tough for everyone to reconcile. I'm thrilled with the competition. I think we move very slowly in the golf world. You know, New Orleans, for example, we jump on and put a foursomes and four ball event together. Everyone's like, oh, this is wild and crazy. It's a foursome four ball event. We should have three or four of them, right? You know, there should be some different options, and that's what this is forcing to happen. We may see some of the concepts, if this Saudi thing goes ahead, as they're talking about, we may see some of their concepts, if the PGA Tour wants, bleed into the PGA Tour. The competition is a part of it that I really enjoy. I don't know. The politics side of it is really uncomfortable to talk about, you know, and there's smarter people than me who'll figure out how that's all going to look. And it'd be interesting to see what players, if they are going to cross over, who's going to cross over. Last point, where are they going to get their players from in the future? You know, because the PGA Tour has access to this unlimited supply chain. Well, where are they going to get theirs from in the future? I don't know. We haven't heard anything about that yet either.
Now, Greg, real quick. If, you know, I love the PGA Tour as well. I mean, it's the greatest brand in golf, no question. But if you're, say, Dustin Johnson or Justin Thomas or one of these guys and this Saudi Tour is offering you, let's say, $150, $200 million, which is honestly apparently what's sort of happening, and you can still play the major championships, okay? So at the end of the day, I think in history, you look at the majors, right, in golf, and you're guaranteed this money like you are in other sports, whether it's, you know, Formula One or whether it's NBA, NFL. Can you blame these guys, Greg, for, you know, looking elsewhere if it's this sort of setup that we're hearing?
Yeah, no. I can't personally, because it'd be hypocrisy, because if you offered me not even just a tenth of that, I would probably jump, right? Because that would be my league of, oh my God, that's the most money I've ever seen in my life, right? You just offered me what I've earned in my career for a year's work. Now, the parts of it that I'm intrigued to see unfold is all the other models like this, you are owned by the people giving you that money. Like the drivers at F1, they don't get to say, hey, it's my kid's birthday, I'll have this weekend off, thanks, right? Golfers as a group, we are used to doing whatever we please. Won't be able to do that, I imagine. If we've only got 12 events and we're giving you $100 million, you're going to get told, here's when you play and here's what you do. It'll be really interesting to see how that unfolds in my eyes, because golfers, just as a group, we're used to just doing whatever we want, Lou, right?
Yeah. I guess the money, if it's that high, you might be able to do what they say if you're getting paid that much guaranteed, you know? But it's going to happen. It's going to happen, Baden, from what we've heard. And I know you've heard rumors, I've heard rumors, and it's looks like it's really happening.
Yeah, totally. And I suppose the only thing about the freedom side of things is the season is way shorter, and the events are, I think there's only 18 events for the year. So, I mean, if you get forced to play 18 events for $120 million, you can probably make yourself do that, I would imagine. So
I think you'll be okay.
Yeah, you'll be okay. But I think you make a really good point, actually, I hadn't thought of, Greg, is that the PGA Tour has got, like, the Chinese tour, they've got obviously South America, they've got the Canadian, they've got like the LA tour, and they've got this incredible feeder program that is obviously bringing, you know, players into the US tour. And they probably, as a consequence, do have some sort of right to say, hey, look, we've basically created you in a sense. Like, we've given you all of the pathways to, you know, to progress as a tour player. You can't just jump ship when you feel like it. Like, there might almost be a situation where you've got a transfer fee like they do in, you know, football, right? Where, you know, you might come through the Arsenal system, but like, to actually transfer over to Man U, you've got to pay this, you know, $100 million fee to actually get that player across or something like that. But I do, you know, because I have heard a lot of people say, well, you know, how can you dare restrict my trade to go and work over there? But if you have been providing an incredible, you know, pathway, maybe the PGA Tour does have a point there.
It'll be interesting. There's so much to unpack here. The other part, Baden, is what do you do? There's no guarantees that your 40 players, that all 40 of them are going to play really nicely.
Yeah.
I mean, we've seen players in the current era really struggling, like Ricky Fowler, for example. You know, 2 years ago, he's a world beater. Right now, he's battling with the game. Well, what do you do if you've got 5 or 10 of your 40 playing like that right now? You don't have a cut and they're going out shooting 78, 75 or something, you know, scores that aren't really worth watching. What do you got in place to move them out of your system? And where do they go then? You know, they've got a lot of money, but I can tell you that they might be bored out of their minds sitting at home doing nothing, right? So, and PDA Tour might shut their door. So there's a lot to really think about, and it's hard to predict the future, but it'll be intriguing to watch.
And the political side of things is huge, obviously. A lot of people don't want to touch sort of Saudi Arabia for, you know, many different reasons, but there is an element to huge growth of the game in Northern Africa, the Middle East, you know, Europe, that, you know, is something that just hasn't been fostered enough. So I think, as you say, there's just there's so many things to play out, and I think we're going to watch it happen over the next year anyway and see what happens. But actually, I just wanted to ask you one more question. So that money being, if you know, he said, I'd jump ship straight away on that, right? I'd, you know, be over there, I'd be playing for that money. Would you do that if you were 23? Do you know what I mean? Like, if you...
Yeah, it's a different discussion, isn't it? And, you know, obviously it's very easy for me, so you're at 48, to say he's a millionaire, which is, it also never going to happen, right? So we know it's... I can clearly say, yeah, I'd probably do it, but I know it's not going to happen, right? So for a young man, you'd have to offer them what they're offering them, which is game-changing, life-changing, set you up for life money, because they're going to make, well, with their retirement and what they'll make on the golf course and off the golf course, they're going to, if they stay on the PGA Tour for the next 15 years, any player that you're talking about in that age bracket who is world-class, they're going to make great money. They're not going to have to worry about a dollar. So if you offer them that straight out of the gate in the next few years, you know, some are going to take it. I don't know. It's the court of public opinion. I mean, didn't they try, you know, something similar with the Premier League over there, where they all tried to jump for money, you know, certain great teams and things like that, and that fell on its face. So it's going to be really interesting to see in the court of public opinion how people go and how the golf fans react to it.
Yeah,
and real quick, we got the Aussie legend Greg Norman spearheading it, which is pretty cool. So I saw an interview with Greg a couple of days ago, and he's very confident. He thinks it's going to be the real deal, which is interesting, right, Greg? The Shark.
Yeah, right. And, you know, and it's an opportunity for the Shark, you know, based on he tried to start the World Golf Championships many years ago. And this is going to be his version of what he wanted back then. And he, you know, to be fair to him, he got worked over a little bit by the PGA Tour, I'd say, in those days. I think that's pretty obvious. And so now this is his opportunity through a different group of people and different financing to see if they can create a competitor. And it sounds like they're going to get up and running.
You don't think Greg Norman would hold a grudge after 20 years, would you? And no chance. But look, all right, well, let's talk more about you in particular, right, Greg? Let's talk about this unbelievable career. Can we just even go back to the very, very start? Because, like, as long as I've, you know, I'm actually only sort of 8 years younger than you sort of thing, but as long as I've been interested, you've been playing on tour, you know, even before you got onto the US tour, you were dominating the Aussie tours and stuff like that. But let's just go back to the very start. Like, how did it all begin for you? What was the catalyst for you realizing, wow, this is the game I want to play for life?
Oh, I picked up the game. My dad's a lefty, so I started when I was about 12, just went out with dad whacking a 7-iron off a tee while he went and played. And I've always had pretty decent hand-to-eye coordination, so I kind of could hit the ball, you know, without many lessons. So dad then bought a set of clubs for Christmas for me under the guise of, if I didn't use them, he would, a set of PGF Slammers. And I got cracking, and I got a handicap, joined Shelley Beach Golf Club, which is called Tugra Lakes Golf Club on the Central Coast of New South Wales in those days. But, yeah, Shelley Beach these days, and, yeah, I played every day. I got a lesson off a coach named Tom Linsky, who's up in Queensland now. And I didn't get a lot of lessons after that. He taught me how to hold the club, and off we went. I just played every day. And I think I was about 15 or 16 when I started to sort of go, how wouldn't mind doing this for a living?
Wow.
And off we go, you know, get after it.
And you got, so within like 3 years, you realized, okay, I'm good enough to, like, what was the first event you played in that?
I got, Oh, sorry to interrupt. Yeah, I don't know if I thought I was good enough. I just thought I wanted to find out if I could be good enough. And you know, I was probably 16 playing off about two or three. And I'd come down from 27 in a few years. And then I quit golf for a year for my last year of high school. I was off. I was playing off about plus one or scratch, and I quit and I went out to about one or two trying to get good grades. And the idea was my grades were going to last 5 years, and then I was going to have 5 year window to either go back to college or back to uni or play golf for a living. And I took that 5 year window. Dad said, if you treat it like a job after the end of high school, I will support you. And I did. I worked hard. I kind of one day off a week, Mondays off. And I worked, you know, practiced my game for usually 3 or 4 hours in the morning, a long game, and then 2 or 3 hours in the afternoon on a short game. So I did that 5 or 6 days a week and got lucky to, you know, win the Australian Amateur when I was 19 and then turned pro 2 years later at 21.
Amazing. So how tall are you, just out of curiosity?
6'1".
Okay, yeah, so you're 6'1". Okay, so you've got a little bit of height to you.
I thought you were going to ask my weight there for a minute too, but let's not go there.
No, but I was going to say, like, for those that haven't watched you play as much as we have, like, you're probably not given, like, Luda's gifts, for example, who's, like, you know, this specimen of a human being, this 6'6", you know, behemoth.
It's a good-looking unit, that's right, yeah.
It generates some speed. You know, you've really built
I
this.
I wish.
You've built this incredible game, which doesn't necessarily have all of the, you know, the weaponry of the modern-day player sort of thing. Did it ever worry you? Like, did you ever think, oh, I'm never going to be long enough or I'm never going to be these things? You were just like, in the same way sort of Nico Hearn did, I suppose, just like so consistent and persistent with your game. How did you sort of think about measuring yourself up against other players and what tools you had?
Right. So, you know, for early on as a pro, it didn't, the length side of things wasn't as much of a factor or anything like it is now. Length has obviously gone from what used to be an asset to now it's a necessity. It has to be part of your skill set, right? So in those days, you know, early 2000s and late 90s when I was sort of first sort of grinding it out, it was more about I tried to look at myself like a company. And so it was more about maintaining, you know, all your positives and then fixing your negatives, you know. And, you know, I looked, if you look at a sort of a graph of my game, chipping and putting was perennially, you know, around a 9 or an 8 out of 10 in terms of, you know, skill set. And then, you know, driving and iron play was closer to anywhere from 4, 5 or 6 out of 10, you know, depending on how well I was doing it week in, week out. So I, you know, went through a sort of a phase where weeks I'd hit it well and I combined everything well, I do great. But more often than not, if I drove it poorly, I was in big trouble. So I was always trying to figure that out. And from a technique standpoint or from a mental attitude standpoint, always trying to get the best out of myself, I guess is the right way to put it. And that's all you ever want to do, right? It's just dive to the bottom of your talent pool. We all have different depths and I'm just trying to get to the bottom of mine.
Now, Greg, if we go to 1998 there, you said the late 90s. One of my first memories watching golf was the Australian Open at Royal Adelaide, 1998. I think you remember that one pretty well. Yeah, I remember walking there and Norman was there, Nick Faudo played, and it was pretty cool for me. I've played Royal Adelaide, you know, a couple hundred times, and it was set up like a US Open, wasn't it? I don't know if you, obviously yeah, you remember, so if you want to touch on that, and you won the tournament, which probably got you really your foot in the door of, you know, world professional golf and all that great stuff.
Yeah, it was actually a really big year for me. I finished 25th on the European Tour that year. Came home. I just returned from the Australian Open. I just returned from the States. I'd qualified for the final stage of Q School. I finished third at Q School to get on the PGA Tour the following year. So I was flying high from that. So I was having big year. Yeah. And then I rolled into the Australian Open, you know, was playing some nice golf. And I wasn't really cognizant of, you know, how I could win this or anything. It just kind of evolved into that as the week went on. Going into the last day, I think I was either one back or something like that. And I think I birdied 3 of the first 5 or 6 and got out of the gate quick and then hung on tight on that back nine with Peter Senior and Stuart Appleby had a putt to tie me on the last hole. So yeah, you know, it was always a dream to win one of those. So, and that was a tough week. It was a kind of week that suits my game a little bit of a grinding week, even par wins. They converted 15 to a par 4 from a par 5. So it was really set up to be really demanding and, it worked out in my favor.
It's great.
So at that stage, so you had your card by that stage. Is that right? Your US card?
Yeah, that was 99 was my rookie year in the States.
Right. So talk to us about that transition. Like, you've been there for 20 years effectively now in America. You've lost your accent completely, which is a real shame, Greg. But
right, yeah.
But what was that transition like for you? Luda's told his story, which is really, really cool, about, you know, whirlwind, 21 on tour, you know, playing in his first event in Hawaii with DJ. What was your first experience like?
You know, it's very daunting, and it's unfortunate. Like, golf, and I always say golf will find your weakness. And in some cases, as Australians, we're brought up to be, don't get too big for your boots, right? And even though I played really great golf that year, I really should have been, and everyone around me who I was, you know, either getting interviewed by was thinking, okay, I was thought of quite highly in terms of, by management, and, you know, this kid's going to be great. I was only 25, I think, at the time, and off we go. Let's go play the States. That wasn't what was going on in my head. In my head, it was, holy, this is scary, right? These are the people I've revered and watched for years. And there's a big thing about success for me, and you have to be able to be comfortable walking through that locker room. You have to have, you know, that chest out, I can beat you kind of feeling. And I didn't have that. And that aside, and then on the golf side of things, the golf courses are set up. We play in Australia and Europe too. You hit it to 20 feet sometimes, that's a good shot. You know, there's some pins, the conditions are vastly different. America, it was fire at that pin, even though it's sometimes the short side misses easier than the fat side, you know. So I just wasn't used to aiming at a lot of pins. I wasn't used to being so visually challenged, which is, you know, water and, you know, lakes and all that kind of stuff. We just didn't have a lot of that in Europe and Australia. So it was very visually off-putting. There was a lot to learn that I really wasn't prepared for, to be honest.
That's brilliant stuff, Greg. I love the honesty, because I battled that forever. You know, as you said, in Australia, call it the tall poppy, call it what you will. But yeah, when I got on the PGA Tour and I'm in the locker room with Phil Mickelson and Ernie Els, I was like, wow, this is crazy. You know what I mean? Like, it's, whereas I think the kids in college in America are taught, oh, you're going to be the man, you're going to win, you're the best. And that mindset's very different. Now for you, when I got on the, at the time, Nationwide Tour, I think it was 2007, you were playing out there at the time. So you sort of chopped and changed. And I really want to know, what was the thing, or the, not saying secret, but what really got you over the edge? Because you ended up winning on the PGA Tour, which, I don't care what anyone says, is a huge deal and not easy to do. So you went from a guy who, you know, was on and off PGA Tour, Nationwide, to a PGA Tour winner who's played, you know, hundreds of events out there. So what do you think really that boiled down to for you?
Some of it was you learn over time that when you get going good, you better ride that wave as hard as you can. And I definitely did that the week that I won. As for up and down, like I was, you know, in 21 years, say over here, 22 years over here, I think I've spent, you know, 5 or 6 years, you know, on that Corn Ferry now, or the Nationwide at the time. The yep. baseline that I had in my head was, I learned pretty quickly, I think I can play golf well enough to make a living, and I just need a place to play. And I also timed any coaching changes that I made based on my performance, or like I was with, say, Dale Lynch for 8 years. And that coincided, the final couple of years coincided with a demotion down to the Nationwide Tour. And I thought, well, it might be time to listen to a different voice. And that happens in coaching, as we all know. And so I went, sure. I went to Colin Swatton. And 2 years later, Colin helped me get back onto the PGA Tour. So whether or not it's through coaching or different voice or some different message. But, yeah, there were some things I was lucky enough to, I guess, have the, I don't know what you call it, just the wherewithal to go, hey, it might be time to listen to something else. And I did that at that point in my career. And Swatto helped me a lot. All of my coaches, to be honest, have helped me a lot. Like, it's at any given point, there's nothing I can ever say negative about any of my coaches. But it's certainly sometimes, if as an athlete, it might be time to hear someone else's voice.
Really interesting. Really interesting. And now you're becoming a coach yourself, which is exciting. So, hey, but let's talk about your putting, right? Because so many people want to hear about it. I've been speaking to people saying that we were going to have a chat to you today, and they just can't wait to hear like your attitude towards putting and how you think about it technically. But like to give people a bit of a background, since 2004, you've finished, this is in strokes gained putting, right? You've finished 4th, 41st, 9th, 5th, 6th, 15th, 1st, 3rd, 11th, 45th, which I don't know happened that year, and then 1st in 2018. Like, arguably the best putter in the world, like over that period. How have you done it? Like, what was it something you were amazing at from the get-go, or is it something that you just have figured out a system yourself to get better at? What do you think has been the key?
There's a lot of combination of things that go into it. A couple of things. One is it's very advantageous. You know, we talk about how we're raised as kids. Well, imagine what I've got is I've been told since I was 12, you're left-handed, you're going to be a good putter. And not just once or twice, hundreds and hundreds and thousands of times, right? So you've got all these people constantly telling you, and that belief pattern just builds and builds and builds, right? That coincided with good work ethic, an understanding or being taught how the putter should move for me, a pretty natural great rhythm and transfer of energy to the ball. And once I learned all of the things, like what I like to do with people is I sort of ask them, particularly good players, like good students, you know, high level golfers, what's it take for you to do this great? And it can be any area of the game. And quite often, if you don't know the answer to that question, I have the answer for my putting, right? I know exactly what it takes for me. I have a list of things that I need to do. And it's not long. It's only 5 or 6 things in terms of setup based, preparation based, mental attitude. But all of those add up to, I know that gives me a chance to hold the putt. And so, yeah, there was a lot to, and then plus I used to wear it out. Like I really loved doing it. And so it was nothing for me to putt for 2 hours at the course and then go home and hit 200 putts at home while I'm watching TV at night in the hotel room or something. It was just something I really enjoyed doing and I wanted to be awesome at it.
That's Greg, I remember 2007 Q score. Did you miss by one shot that year?
Bogeyed the last with my coach, Colin Swatton, on the bag. I tell you a funny story, Ludo. I tell you a funny story quickly. I called my wife after I bogeyed the last to miss my card, and I knew I had to go back and play the Corn Ferry Nationwide the next year. She said, okay, what are you going to do? And I said, look, I'm just going to go in the clubhouse and I'm going to cry for a little while and then I'll jump on a plane and I'll be home.
Well, I've got a butt in there because I choked it at the end, but somehow got through on the number. I don't know. I think I was playing the group behind you. But I was on the plane with Colin back to Swatto, back to Australia that night. And we're talking and he's like, dude, holy shit, I've never seen anything like this. And I said, what? He goes, Chalmers didn't leave a putt short in 6 rounds of golf. And I said, what do you mean? He goes, he's the best putter I've ever seen. I'm like, dude, come on, you caddy for Jay Day. He's like, no, he didn't leave a putt short in 6 rounds of golf. And I'm like, that's impossible. Whether you got a 50-footer or a 30-footer. And he goes, mate, he's the best putter I've seen. And I'll never forget that, Greg. And I guess it was true. You are a great putter. So it was a great story, but incredible. That's interesting.
Yeah, I would say, you know, speed control, I've definitely had, you know, the way I transfer what I call transfer energy or speed to the ball is very consistent. I hit it out of the middle a lot. I've worked really hard on a lot of those aspects of it. I took a lot of that for granted. I got to be honest, you know, like I will say that I remember one time I was playing a practice round somewhere and I work with Neil Smith, sports psych, Australian sports psych. And Neil Smitty said to me, he said, how's your putting been? I said, oh, it's been terrible this year. And he goes, really? And he said, have a look at that. And he looked over the scoreboard. It said, Greg Chalmers running 5th in strokes gained. Right. And I had no idea. I was like, oh. And then he said, yeah, these guys, some of them, they might not be as good as you think they are. And I'm like, okay. But yeah, sometimes you get a little immersed and you don't realize that you're actually doing something pretty well.
So talked about, like you said, that you were obviously being told you were going to be an incredible putter. You started believing that. Did you think you were the best putter in the world? Like, do you allow yourself as an Aussie in particular to tell yourself that?
No, I just knew it was a strength. And so I just kept working at it to maintain it. I didn't really think, I wasn't arrogant enough, I guess, and I probably should have at some point. So, hey, you're on a journey here to be someone who could be really good at this. I think the biggest thing is, you know, from a reputation standpoint, most of them were probably for par. You know, so that's the problem, right? You get up and down all the time. So, you know, if you're a Brad Faxon and you win seven times and, you know, compete at a really, you know, high level all the time, week in, week out, people sort of look at it and go, oh, wow, I see that now. But I wasn't on TV enough to warrant getting in that discussion, even though the stats support the, you know, the idea that I could do it well. I just have a, you know, let me rattle off a list of things. I really don't care about stance width at all. I've putted really well with wide, narrow. I just want you to be comfortable. I care about the hips and up. I want the forearms and the shoulders and everything to be aligned nicely. I care about eye line. I know where my eyes need to fall. I care about square eyes. And I care about tempo of the putter. I care about, you know, ball position as well. But a lot of people, I think they confuse slow with better. If I get too slow, I actually get more hit to my stroke on the takeaway particularly. So I have worked really hard on continuing the tempo on the rim away from the ball. And now we have stats on that through either blast motion or pick anything that says, you know, a lot of people have a bit of a zippier tempo is better for you than a slower tempo in some cases. Yeah. Obviously not for everyone, but I come up with a list of things and then I just had a good attitude about it. And that's part of the challenge for a lot of people is just having a good attitude and good expectations.
Now, Greg, you've got that McGregor mallet still in the bag. How long's that been in the bag?
Bobby Grace, baby. Yeah, Bobby Grace.
Bobby Grace.
Yeah, he gets a week off.
I had a guy write in saying the rumors were Greg used to take two putters a week from the putting green on tour. He used to chop and change, but I didn't see that. Were you always switching putters up or were you just a one putter guy?
No, I would. I tried a bunch of putters, but I never took them. I've got a garage. I think I have about 20 putters in my garage, and there's only two worth keeping, probably. I'm not a hoarder. I try them, and then I've had my putter tested on Quintic. You know, it's technology, and it's phenomenal. And the guy looked at it and he said, "This balance on this putter is unbelievable. It's, you know, because it's a, you can't buy it off the rack. It's kind of a handmade deal with specifically for me. And he makes good stuff. And we just fell on a rainbow, you know, it was really cool."
And do you think that every putter is specific to every person? Like, do you prefer mallets or it doesn't really matter? Or how do you think about helping people fit themselves into a putter?
You know, I think what I say to people, and I'm doing putting clinics in my club right now, if you find something that you love, just understand the family you're in, you know, whether it's a face balance with high MOI or whether it's like mine, which is 30-degree toe drop with high MOI, or if you like blade putters like Mickelson likes, if you like that family, stay in that family just for a little while. I never understood why people would dance around. Probably the best known player that I've seen who goes within face balance to toe drop was Jim Furyk. Like, Jim won the FedEx Cup with a yes putter that was a blade. And then I've seen him do really well putting with a face balance high OMI Odyssey or something, or Bettinardi. So that baffles me sometimes because they perform totally differently. But I would say just to people, you amateurs out there, you know, just try and figure out what the family is and understand how face balance works a little bit, and just understand how your putter works. And aside from that, you need a little bit of technology to figure out how the ball performing. But we can do that a lot with cameras and things like that these days and put a line on the ball. So obviously it's the only piece of the equipment you're holding. So you need to get it somewhat close to right.
Is your McGregor face balance, Greg, or has that got a little bit of toe hack?
No, I hate face balance myself. So
interesting. I didn't know that. Yeah. I just assumed that was face balance.
No, it's actually got about 30 degrees of toe drop. He changed the shaft setup so that it bends a little differently. And I like, and the other thing I would say is enjoy what you're looking at. I like the line on the putter to go all the way up to the end of the putter. I don't like that to be broken down, but that's fine if you don't like that. If you like the line to be broken by some piece of other part of the putter, that's fine. If you like two lines, I hate that. You know, find out what you and fall in love with what you like and then kind of stick to those parameters is my take on how to pick your equipment. Because, you know, as an example, I like Royal Grips on my putter, the company. Now, they went broke years ago. I bought the last 70 grips on eBay for $6 each, right? Right. Can't get them anymore, but I got them. like what you're holding and like what it looks like and fall in love with it a little bit.
So I think, you know, Hogan said the putting is the game within the game, effectively. And so many people I know struggle with it. Like, they really do. Like, it's actually pretty rare you meet a really good putter. You know, you rarely go out there. I mean, maybe on the US tour. I don't play on the US tour, Greg. But when you go and play with even pretty good players, you never stand there and go, wow, this guy just holds everything. It's a very, very hard art to get right. And for the average person, it can be almost impossible. And the biggest thing I see is that, you know, beyond even the technical side of things, is that their speed control is terrible. Like, people have absolutely no idea how to judge speed. Have you got like a couple of tips? Like, say someone is completely lost, they just don't know how to control their speed, what their starting line is. They can't even see as a consequence. Like, I actually find that when people don't know how to judge speed, they can't read putts, they don't see the slopes the right way. What would you recommend to someone? Like, where do you start to get that right? Is it just a case of just spend hours on the putting green, or is there stuff you can do?
Not always, you know, because first of all, the first step for a lot of people is just managing your expectations, you know, because let's understand, like, from 10 feet on a breaking putt, I got a lot of people I'm teaching right now at my club who are, the expectation is they should make 5 out of 10. When reality is, a PGA Tour average is 4 out of 10, and 2 out of 10 gets you on the tour. So, and they hit 3 putts before they go play, right? So let's not roll onto the first tee expecting to be perfect with speed control when we really haven't put a lot of love into, you know, getting ready. Now, having said all of that, from a technique standpoint, I see a lot of people, particularly, they move an awful lot in their lower half, right? Which to me affects set and contact. You know, you're only trying to move the putter like a foot and a half. Like, and to generate the energy you need to hit the ball 30 feet or 20 feet, whatever the difference is, to me, it'll be great if we could just have the big muscles upstairs controlling all of that. And we do that by stabilizing the lower half a little bit. I don't know if you guys ever remember seeing years ago, way back when, there's footage of Arnold Palmer hitting putts, and his toes are pointing in, he's all leaned in, he's locking his hips down, right? Yeah. And that's one way to do it. There's other ways you can do it. But basically, the stability in the lower half means go up the chain, and now the energy is being generated by the big bits that we want up top, the shoulders, hair, arms, and hopefully not too many hands, but you can putt great with hands too. But that's what I try and push people towards. The other thing is quality of contact. You can't hit one out of the heel, one out of the toe, and two out of the middle and expect they're all going to go the same distance and where you want to, regardless of speed and length of stroke. So we have to deal with getting that ball coming out of the middle of the face, right? So I've got some drills we can do for that.
Great. Hey, Greg, real quick, what are your thoughts on, you know, Jack Nicklaus's putting stroke? Obviously, the greatest player ever, and putting's changed over time, hasn't it? I mean, you look at the old footage of Nicklaus and Hogan and these guys, and it was almost like a piston, sort of like a wristy thing, and now it's obviously, you know, you, Tiger, look so solid. It's big muscles. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think my take is that the strokes have evolved based on the conditions. You know, when you watch old footage of Nicklaus putting on the 16th, say, the putt he made on the 16th at Augusta, I think it was back in the, who knows when, I'm not a history guy, so please don't roast me on that, but back in the 70s, he smashed it. Like, it looks like the greens are running probably what those greens should run at, which is about 8, right? Yeah. Because there's so many slopes. Now we get these things running at 12, 13, at a competitive level.
14.
Right. And even your clubs sometimes, you know, they ramp them up. They're all around 10 to something usually. So the stroke had to evolve to deal with being more consistent with its delivery. It's hard to be really consistent when you're really wristy and handsy like they were. Now, when the greens are slow and you whack it too hard, it goes another foot. You know, it doesn't go that much further because the greens aren't rolling fast enough for it to go anywhere. And I know you, Ludo, you and I have both played in Asia. I really struggled in Asia because they were so slow. My technique was built around this nice, calm delivery of energy. You really need to whack them when you went there, right? And I
struggled. I thought you liked putting on Velcro, Greg. I thought you liked putting on Velcro.
Exactly. So bad, right?
And exactly.
So, yeah, the strokes evolve based on the conditions. I'm sure if we played on Velcro every week, as you say, we'd all be like, well, this ain't going to work. Let's go back to this wristy, wacky kind of action.
So, Greg, this has just been an absolutely incredible conversation. Honestly, I could talk to you about this all day long. And, yeah, I think I'm going to work with you on Skillist on my stroke. Mate, and on that, it's just super exciting to have you involved. Like, for students and people across the world to now have access to potentially the greatest putter over the past 20 years on Skillet is obviously exciting for us, but it's just, it's pushing us closer and closer to our vision, which is like giving them access to the best. And it's just super, super cool to have you involved. And we're actually running a competition. So you're giving away a putting stroke analysis and then also a Zoom with someone who just subscribes to the pod and then leaves a comment. So anyone that does that, we're just going to pick someone out and you're going to be able to get an incredible analysis from Greg. So that'll be super cool. So make sure you do that. Luda, how cool was that? Like, could talk about
that. Fantastic. I've got one final question for Greg. Hey, Greg, who's the best putter you've seen besides yourself, mate?
Good question.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one. So I've played with Tiger when he played really, really well. Some of the ones that are unknown that you probably, you know, people don't talk about much, guy like Brian Gay, who was apparently very good. I love Snedz's action. You know, we all know Snedeker is very good at it. You know, and I catch these guys when they're hot with a putter and it's pretty fun to watch sometimes. I've always really enjoyed it. You can tell I enjoy talking about it and I'm passionate about it. So, you know, thanks for having me on today. I really appreciate it, guys.
No, anyone out there, if you're struggling with your putting or you want an opinion, you'd be crazy not to get a lesson with Greg Chalmers. It's awesome. Fantastic.
I think you're doing a slight discount on your price at the moment as well for a short period until you get flooded. So good. now's a good time to get in there. So everyone, once again, thank you so much for joining us. Make sure, as I said, like, subscribe, send it on to other people. Anyone that can't putt has to listen to this, obviously. And we will see you next week for the next Skillers Pod.